Not every soil health building practice is going to work the same way on every farm. And that's one of the reasons we call it a journey. Sometimes that journey can lead to unexpected places. For Maryland farmer Trey Hill, one of those places was figuring out how to plant green.
You know, one day he was planting green and the tern rows had been killed off. And he's like, Trey, come out here. You got to see this. You got to quit killing these cover crops. This is just planting beautiful. And this was, you know, two people that shouldn't have liked it. You know, we were both kind of looking at each other going, what's going on here? Like, this doesn't make sense. Neither one of us should believe this or agree with it. But we both saw it and we're like, wow.
On today's episode, Trey Hill of Harborview Farms in Maryland shares his soil health journey into cover crops, no-till, and planting green. This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. On this show, we unpack the ways farmers collaborate to build healthier soils and adapt systems to work on their farm for both sustainability and profitability. Let's get to the root of all that and cover some ground on today's episode of Soil Sense. Hey there, thanks for tuning in to Soil Sense. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Hamrich. Joining me, of course, is my co-host, Dr. Abby Wick, and we're sitting down today with Maryland farmer Trey Hill. Trey's operation, Harborview Farms, is located in Rock Hall, Maryland. That's directly across the Chesapeake Bay from Baltimore and right in between Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. as the crow flies on the Delmarva Peninsula. For years, Trey has been a vocal advocate for engaging with consumers and environmental groups to find solutions that are both great for the planet and for farmer viability and profitability. At Harborview Farms, they grow corn, soybeans, wheat, barley, and peas on just over 10,000 acres. Trey has a really interesting story of how practices such as incorporating cover crops, reducing tillage, and planting green have made farming more fun for him and improved his soil without sacrificing yields. I asked if he'd start off our conversation by sharing a little bit more about the backstory to this soil health journey.
I mean, for me, it comes down to no-till and cover crops is kind of the basis of all of it. I mean, that seems to be the key to it. Tillage definitely, you know, takes you back. We do a little bit of tillage here and there. You know, if we have a manure pile or a real heavy trafficked area, you know, compaction is the enemy. But I would say that in terms of soil health, no-till would be the first part, but we could never get yields on parity with conventional until we incorporated cover crops. And now we plant green and try to get, you know, living roots all year and that sort of thing. I'm still, you know, struggling with measurements and baselining and all these other things that I think we're all, you know, struggling to figure out what soil health really is.
Yeah, I'm curious about that piece of the no-till and the cover crops. Which came first for you, and how did that look timeline-wise as to when you adopted the different practices?
We always no-tilled some, but we typically did tillage like every third year or every other year. We've always had double crop beans, so we'd always harvest wheat. And even as a child, we would harvest wheat and then plant beans into the wheat straw. So the planting green thing was probably a little easier for me. So no-till wasn't farm. We just always got compaction. And I think that not having something living in the soil over the wintertime is what caused the compaction to increase exponentially. I think we would actually pick up compaction over the winter. You know, they say that the freezing and the thawing breaks up compaction, but I don't really think it does, or at least we don't get cold enough maybe. So when we incorporated cover crops, the reason I grew cover crops is because the state paid me to do it. They got a bunch of funding together. I helped, you know, get the funding. And it was more the environmentalists pushing it. And this was 25 years ago, I'd say, when we started. And I thought it was kind of a dumb idea, to be honest. And really didn't think it did much, but it helped us. We have a lot of waterfowl hunting here. So if you put out cover crops, the waterfowl love it. You know, so from an ecological standpoint, it was great. And it made hunting a lot better, which was one of my passions. So for me, it was kind of a win-win. And then we would kill the cover crops off in early March. And we'd get our money and get paid. And, you know, I mean, I think it helped, but it didn't really do a whole lot. And then there were a couple of years where we couldn't get them killed off. And then we had to start planting green and learning that. And that's when we started to really see soil health. So that was probably, I don't know, 15 years ago. And we started to see that they were easier to plant. You know, we'd have a wet spring and we could plant the fields with cover crop before we could plant the ones without cover crop. Or we'd be working the ground to dry it out, causing compaction, which, you know, all farmers know that working wet ground is a bad thing. But if you're like me, you do it to dry the ground out and you know that it's working against you. So that it was more of an evolution. It wasn't really a decision that one year, oh, we're going to plant everything green, or oh, we're going to do everything cover cropped. Or this was before soil health was really a thing, or I'd even I don't think anyone was really talking about, or I wasn't talking about soil health 15 years ago. We were just seeing differences in the soil. And then, you know, the guys that I work with, our team, you know, as they'd go to plant, we have one gentleman that taught me how to plant and drive a tractor. You know, he grew up with my father. And, you know, one day he was planting green and the turn rows had been killed off. And he's like, Trey, come out here. You got to see this. You got to quit killing these cover crops. This is just planting beautiful. And this was, you know, two people that shouldn't have liked it. You know, we were both kind of looking at each other going, what's going on here? Like, this doesn't make sense. Neither one of us should believe this or agree with it. But we both saw it and we're like, wow. So the next year we just kind of kept increasing it. And I never wrote it down when it was. I remember where it was. And I remember the conversation. But it was just one of those things that, you know, you wish you had a diary so you could go back and look and see when, you know, everything kind of changed in your mind. So I would say it was, no-till was very familiar to us 30 years ago. Cover crops were probably 20, 25, but really planting green and focusing on soil health was probably 15 years ago. And then I would say 7 or 8 years ago is where I really got into the whole climate change, carbon sequestration, increasing organic matter, trying to quantify things. And I guess just kind of drank the Kool-Aid and decided that's what we were going to, you know, or we decided that's what we were going to do.
And you mentioned it's planting beautifully, you know, that first year in planting green. A couple questions with that. Number one, what other benefits have you seen from planting green? But also, number two, I'm sure it hasn't just been like all of a sudden it was easy. And from there, it was just smooth sailing. You know, what challenges have come up since?
Oh, no, it definitely is. I mean, you have to be dedicated to it. I mean, it's still not that rosy. I've got some cornfields now. You would fail to take advice from me if you saw we're out trying to do some corrective measures now. I mean, it's still really hard to sleep when you plant green. I struggle with it, as does my team. You can't scout your fields when you get into the real big stuff. It gets really hard to do stand assessments. It gets really hard to see. I mean, when you don't see your crop for a month, you know, as it's coming up out of the bottom, you know, the depths of these cover crops, it gets pretty tricky. This year, I had a lot more rye than legumes. My carbon to nitrogen ratio got way high on me. We didn't spray the rye off, and in hindsight, should have. And then we got a bad drought. It's just started to rain now, but we didn't have any rain for a month. So all of the normal breakdown of those nutrients and that return into the soil that I'd become accustomed to weren't there. So I've got some yellowing corn just because the cycle's not really working due to Mother Nature. And, you know, we're going to learn from it and grow. But, you know, the plan is next year, we're probably going to go out with some clethodim. We're probably going to plant the rye a little less thick. We're probably going to kill some of the rye on the stuff we're going to plant later and really, you know, enhance that legume population and the mustard population. You know, we didn't really foresee this happening. It's not every acre, but it's enough. Getting the planter set up correctly can take a lot. If you have the wrong row cleaners and they start to tangle, I like row cleaners. Some people don't. I've used them forever, and that's just what we do. I think it's right. I think it helps with slugs, and I think it helps with the gauge wheels making seed to soil contact to get more even depth. If you've got ones that tangle, you're dead in the water, right? You know, and what are you going to do? You're going to go order brand new ones and change your whole planter over that day. So getting those things aligned, it's really hard to close the trench. I still find that to be a struggle. It seems very, very fundamental, but I find it to be quite a challenge because you get so much more variation in the soil as you plant that getting that row closed without compacting it and without really sealing it can be tricky. We've got a bunch of different options. I mean, we're doing a good job of it now, but those are some of the impediments to really getting into it. Because if you just take your conventional planter, you get the wrong row cleaners, you get the wrong closing wheels, you go out there and try it, and you can't plant, you're not going to do it again. So getting all those things just from a procedural standpoint are kind of tricky. And then the really hard part, well, for us, slugs are the main problem. It's really the only problem we have in our system, and slugs are just a menace. We spread slug bait, and we've gotten better at that. But if an animal doesn't have a nervous system or a respiratory system, it's really hard to kill. Believe it or not, which you would think would be very easy to kill because they look like they're, you know, little dumb animals, but there isn't really anything to kill them. You know, I've researched everything, and I know that people say don't use seed treatments, but then I like to plant early. So a lot of times it's cold and wet. So those are probably the biggest challenges I've seen.
I want to go back to a couple things you said. You said, you know, what initially got you started on cover crops was the incentive that was being offered, the financial incentive. But then also that you think it really has helped with compaction that you were seeing through your no-till program before then. Those are obviously two of the benefits. Are there any other benefits that you've really seen from cover crops that keep you committed to the system?
in a drought, we definitely do better. And I think that I like it in the spring. I think it keeps the soil a little more even temperatured. We don't get as much replant unless it's from slugs, but we get a lot better emergence if the cover crops are there. We're seeing a lot more earthworms. We're building organic matter. We're doing a certification now for regenerative practices. And we're soil sampling the top 6 inches versus the bottom six, 1 to 6 and 6 to 12. And we're seeing some pretty significant increases in organic matter. So the soil was homogenized. You know, we were plowing to 18 inches. We're firm believers in really deep. I'm like the worst person to have gone the regenerative path. I mean, we love tillage. Like, we love big rippers. We ripped in the fall. We ripped in the spring. Like, it didn't matter how much fuel it took. Like, that's what we did. And the deeper, the better. But now we're seeing some pretty significant increases, which is makes me feel good. So, you know, when I look at my kids and I know if they farm or whoever farms the land, you know, is getting increased organic matter, you know, that's coming along pretty quickly. Bean yields, I think, are up a little bit. Wheat yields are up a little bit. Corn, corn's still a little bit of a struggle. I'm still learning. I haven't learned as fast as I should have.
And you mentioned earlier that, you know, it's hard to get yields with no-till that are on par with conventional tillage, but you think that overall, and maybe less so on the corn, it sounds like, but overall you've seen that with the help of the cover crops?
I think that the issue that I had trying to compare straight no-till with conventional tillage was we were getting compaction issues. And if you don't do something, your cash crop is not going to alleviate compaction. I mean, corn does a nice job, but it's not actually going to take out a compacted layer. And once it's gone, if there's like, I mean, we were putting like for when we first got glyphosate resistant weeds, we were putting our residuals on in the fall. And I mean, it worked beautifully. I mean, my field stayed completely clean until the spring and we never had anything grow on the field for 6 months. Well, what we plowed would do much better than what we didn't plow. There wasn't any way around it. Now, beans, we could do no-till and get the same yields. And wheat's kind of funny. Wheat, if it's after beans, we could, but wheat's a little different. But corn, we just couldn't. You know, we had to plow every 2 or 3 years to get good yields, or at least as good of yields. So we would do a mix. But I find that with the cover crops, you're actually doing something, right? You've got that ground cooking all winter long. And if you get big cover crops, if you get into that 4 or 5 tons of biomass, like stuff that's up to your waist, and you've got a mix of mustards and legumes and a cereal rye or a wheat out there, I mean, you've got a lot of roots going down. You go down with a shovel, and you go down, you know, 8, 10 inches, and there's just solid roots and earthworms. So I think that's what's helping offset that yield drag. Now I'm planting green. I think there's a couple other reasons why we have a yield drag. One of it's nutrient tie up, which I'm trying to learn. And that's tricky. I had USDA out here for 5 years doing research. And most of the nutrients now are getting back within 90 days. So we're front loading our starter a little bit. We're putting a little more next to the crop because we know we're taking it up with the cover crops. We're putting our broadcast fertilizer out earlier. So we're not doing it at planting. We might do that mid-March. And we're actually fertilizing the cover crops. I wouldn't have thought made sense. But then now that we know that we're getting it back, it makes sense. So we're actually boosting that root mass early to plan on planting later because we want the cover crops to have more vigor. Here, we're not allowed to put any fertilizer on in the fall because of Maryland nutrient management, but we find that works pretty well. Now, I think the only tie up is one, the nutrients, which we're figuring is that's something you can figure out. And then it's getting that even seed to soil contact and getting even emergence. I think that the cover crops help because they slow down the emergence. And you would say you want it to emerge really quickly, which you would in conventional, you want it to be hot. But I think that it evens out some of the unevenness if it's coming out slower. You know, you don't have as high a temperatures in the day. You don't have as low a temperatures at night. And I think that kind of smooths it out. So we're still working through that. I mean, we're growing good corn. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, we're growing, you know, under a pivot. I'm right there with my peers, but it's just a little trickier.
I have a question on the row cleaner part, because I feel like no-tillers either use row cleaners or they don't. And so when you're using your row cleaners, what is the setting? Are they going deep in the soil? Are they just touching the surface? Or what do you do for that, that piece of equipment?
I spend an hour on row cleaners. I'm passionate about row cleaners, and closing wheels are my passions. Two of my passions. No, we use a intermeshed Martin system that's similar to the shark tooth that Yetter makes, but they're intertwined. So they clank on one another and so they're self-cleaning essentially. And then we run a gauge wheel, like a 1-inch band on that. So they're barely touching the soil is the objective. We've got air pressure cylinders on them But we're typically running between 10 and 50 pounds is the objective. And then they have parallel linkage on them. And I think that makes them ride a little bit smoother. And then they have a little back plate that keeps it from tangling. But so no, we're not running them very aggressively. I don't think with the cereal rye, you can't, and vetch, you can't really, you know, once you start digging into stuff and pulling stuff up, then it can be a mess. I'm not saying that's right. That's just what we do. And that's what keeps our planters moving.
I think that's helpful because a lot of farmers, when they get into planting green or into cover crops, you know, the idea of getting in deep and making a black strip with your row cleaners is kind of where their mind goes. So here you keep your shallow and they're just kind of, you know, clanking along the surface is really helpful.
Yeah, we just want to make it so that the gauge wheel is riding as close to the soil as we can, because I think that one of the yield limitations, particularly in corn and no-till planted green, is even depth. To get even depth with proper sealing, you know, is the key to, you know, high yielding corn. I mean, any of the agronomic books you read say that. Well, all of a sudden now you're planting over, you know, root balls of cereal rye that it's just not going to happen. So if you can get some of that cleared away, we've run into a few little issues. One was we were running Martin's fertilizer discs in front. We don't run a no-till colder. And as the row cleaners would push the cover crop down, that knife would then slice the cover crop at the root. And when we would spray, we were getting an interaction where the herbicide wouldn't kill the cover crops where it had been sliced off. So you run into little surprises here and there where, like, you know, you get everything planted and you're all done. And you're like, wait a second, why is there all this cover crop in the row? Well, we thought it was because of the starter fertilizer, right? We were putting down starter and we're like, oh, well, it got over-fertilized. Well, come to find out it was because as that stuff was leaning over, this was cutting it off like hairline cutting it right at the root, and we weren't getting proper kills. So we switched out that fertilizer system for the conceal system. So we're putting it on with the gauge wheels because we were cutting so much of that cover crop so close to the roots that we couldn't get the chemicals to work properly. And now we're running conceal with the row cleaners in a 2x2x2. So it's on, putting it on both sides of that gauge wheel. And that gauge wheel is kind of curved out at the outside. So you don't really need as much of the row cleaned. It's almost like a skinny gauge wheel. You know, they have a gap in the middle of the gauge wheel and it works pretty well. But we don't have a full width gauge wheel running anymore on the ground because we found that the skinnier gauge wheels made it so we didn't have to clean as much with the row cleaners and we were getting a little bit better depth control.
Well, you'd mentioned earlier the questions you're still asking regarding kind of the nutrient management with the cover crops. What other questions related to soil health are you asking on your farm and trying to experiment with?
I don't know. I still struggle with how to quantify soil health. You know, chemicals are obviously a big one. You know, I mean, are chemicals bad for soil health? I'd say, you know, I mean, to me, chemicals are probably bad for everything other than people eating. But people eating is certainly the most important thing, right? You know, the person that doesn't have enough food to eat has one problem, and those that have enough to eat have many problems. So I think the chemicals are necessary, but it's what is their effect? And it seems like when you go to listen to the people that talk about it and research it, they'll say either all chemicals are bad or no chemicals are bad. And I'm going, well, I don't know how many different chemicals, right? I mean, it's a lot. And I use a lot of fungicides. And I don't know what their effect is on soil health. Right. I mean, if you have a fully canopied bean crop and it's 3 feet tall and you can't see the bottom, I can't get any chemical on the bottom leaves because I'm trying to. Is that hurting soil health to put a fungicide on it? And I don't know that anyone really knows. And I don't know what the measurement is. You know, is it bacteria to fungus ratios? Is it certain funguses? Is it certain bacteria? And I think if we could get into like the DNA footprinting of soils and things like that and really see, because what my goal on our farm is, well, one, we've greatly reduced the amount of insecticide we're using because I think bugs are probably good. I think that's pretty easy. Low hanging fruit. We still use, the only insecticide we use is either in furrow or on seed. And then if we get an infestation of, you know, say spider mites or grasshopper or something like that, but we found that we're getting less infestation. So I've kind of bought into that theory. So we'll spray occasionally, but we pulled most of those out. We've reduced a lot of rates on things like we use atrazine and metallochlor, and mesotrione is kind of my, you know, pre-emerge on corn, one trip pass with either glyphosate or paraquat. And we've been able to reduce our rates. We use Lexar from 5 pints to 3 pints and get good control. So I figure that's a victory, right? I'm using a lot less. That's a victory, you know, from environment or from a, you know, just a cost perspective. We get a lot of weed control out of the cover crops. So that's still where we're kind of figuring things out. Is it worth trying to take all the chemicals out? And then you run the risk of weeds and all this stuff, you know, as far as its impact on soil health. Because I send stuff away and my soils are healthy. And I'm like, well, if they're healthy, do I really need to take those chemicals out? You know, or why are they healthy? Or am I not measuring it properly? You know, I think there's still a lot of things up in the air there.
Yeah, I think that's a great practical approach, right? I mean, you don't need to be eliminating everything to be successful. I think there's a fine balance in there that you're saying can be achieved and you can feel good about what you're doing.
Yeah, I think it has to be a journey, right? I mean, you don't start running and run a marathon tomorrow, right? You you run a mile, then you run a 5K, then you do a 10K, then you do a half, then you might never do a marathon, right? It's a big deal. So, you know, right now I'm probably running a 5K, maybe a 10K, we'll see. But, you know, I'm pretty proud of myself for doing that, right? It's better than sitting on the couch. So I think that to me is important, but you go to meetings and be like, oh, are you regenerative? And I'll go, who knows? You know, like, I think so. Like, but then they want to, you know, oh, well, you use chemicals, so you're not. Okay, I'm not. Whatever, I'm on my journey. You know, like, I'm just trying to do better. You know, I'm trying to make some money along the way. And, do what I can, make my team proud, and, you know, and have a group of folks that work with me that are proud of what we do, and always trying to do better is just our goal. I think if you just turn everything off, you're just going to hurt yourself.
Well, it seems like, you know, some of these opportunities that you're able to take advantage of now is because of this 25-year long, you know, journey into soil health. If you're talking to a group of farmers that may be kind of where you were in terms of a soil health journey 25 years ago, what would be the top things you would share with them that might accelerate, you know, their progress? Or is it just something that has to take, you know, 25 years?
I mean, I think there's a lot more information out there now. And when we started, we were doing just cereals. And I think that was a huge mistake, because if you really want to screw up your nutrient cycle, plant cereals and then plant grass into it, corn. And I think that's what really, I mean, that really hurt a lot of farmers here from progressing, because we would plant, you know, corn into cereal rye and just get a huge yield hit and you could never get it right. You know, it's a legume mix or a legume based mix for going into corn, cereals going into soybeans with a little bit of legumes. The more diverse, the better. Don't plant them too thick, you know, so you can plant through it, and just be prepared when you plant. You're going to run slower, you're going to start later, you're going to quit earlier. If you have to, we have high humidity. I think some of those things are pretty straightforward and you can do it without a lot of risk. I'd plant green. I think the only way to do it is to plant green. So I think it's just dive in the deep end and plant green. Just make sure you have the right mix. And if you get some flowers out there in the spring and stuff, it's very rewarding. You know, you get people stopping by your fields, looking at how pretty they are. You know, if you get crimson clover out there with a little bit of canola or rapeseed, I mean, it's just gorgeous. I've talked to folks in the Dakotas and stuff, and I'm like, all right, I don't know anything about where you are. Like, I'm the wrong person to talk to. But I think that just doing some of that stuff is pretty easy stuff. And don't expect a miracle. And then also in the cycle for nutrients, particularly, it's going to be 3 years before you're getting the nutrients back within 90 days. So if you plant a lot of cereal rye and you let it get big and you get a high carbon to nitrogen ratio, which basically just means, it took me forever to figure this out, but what it means is when it turns to straw, you know, when it's not going to die, when it's just going to stay standing forever. Once it gets to that height, you're going to have some issues. Shading in corn can be an issue, but most of that's, if you plant legumes and you kill them, they're gone in like 30 days and you get all the nutrients back that they took up. Plus you're getting like a 30 or 40 pound push of nitrogen on top of it. So it makes it fairly easy, easier, I'll say. And it's easy to plant through because they're real squishy. You don't get the big root masses. And that's, I'd say, the direction we've been moving in is less and less cereal and more legumes.
When you mentioned what you're doing there in Maryland versus what we would do up here in the Dakotas, what advice would you have for people listening to the Soil Sense podcast now, who are going to be hearing from farmers all over 20 different states? You know, how would you encourage them to process this information and to then turn around and be able to use some of this on their own operations?
I mean, just figure out what overwinters. You know, we fly a lot on with an airplane. We used to do more than we do now, but, you know, you can fly it on and it'll come up and you don't have to spend a whole lot on it. And that way you can get some fall growth. I like getting the fall growth. So I would say that would be the only thing I would, I'm not familiar with it enough to really speak on it with any type of, I couldn't live there. I mean, it's a whole different world. Like, people talk about the temperatures and I'm just like, whoo, that's not, I couldn't do it. I'm not tough enough. So I don't really have a lot of advice there, but you got to get something green and growing, because the reason you can't do no-till in a lot of places is because the ground stays too cold and wet. if you've got something growing on it, it absorbs a lot of moisture and it gives you a lot better percolation rates and the soil stays more arid. So I would say if your issue is that the soil is too cold and wet in the spring for no-till, which is why a lot of people do fall tillage, for me, cover crops have replaced a lot of that tillage. And it's a different concept, but in terms of moisture, now the ground will stay cooler than your conventional, but the corn comes up a little slower and it's also protected more because you don't have the large swings in temperature, which is, if you get like a corkscrewing or something like that, where you have poor emergence, people attribute it to cold weather. A lot of times it's not necessarily the coldness as much as it is the temperature variation from cold to warm. And I found that if you have living roots in the soil, a lot of times it buffers that delta. The other thing is sometimes we plant and we might not spray for a couple of weeks. You know, there's lots of options to kill the cover crop once the corn's emerged. You know, if you have glyphosate resistant corn, you can hit it with glyphosate and then like a Lexar product like I use, but you've got all kinds of options for post and the stuff's pretty easy to kill usually. The mustards are a little tough to kill, but you know, that would be my advice is if you're looking at going to no-till and getting away from tillage would be let that cover crop replace your tillage.
Awesome. Wow, we could go for a full another hour, I think, on this. This is great. Trey, just the last question for you. Anything that comes to mind that we didn't get to that you think is really relevant to an episode on your soil health journey?
I think that the main thing is just staying open-minded. And like I said, when George and I were out in the field and looked at the planted green versus brown, I'll never forget it because it went against everything that I ever thought was true about agriculture. And now I'm just like, I think that just being able to do the cover crops and planting green to me has been very freeing. I just enjoy it. It's a challenge and it's fun. You know, there's farming is so stressful, right? You know, you've got the board of trade, you've got weather, you've got all this stuff. It was very easy for me to not have fun farming, which I think was a big reason for me going into this journey is it made farming fun again. It wasn't just a logistics play of, you know, get the planter here, get this, that, there. And it just seems like you get sucked into that world of just doing logistics. And it's fun and it's challenging. But for me, the cover crops and soil health and just relearning how we farmed and why we farmed, it gave me a lot of identity to get out from underneath my father's weight or his reputation. I mean, he's a brilliant guy with an awesome reputation. So if you've got that going for you, it's great. But it also kind of sucks in some ways because you know, everybody, you're compared to your father for the rest of your life. There's still people that tell me how smart my father was, which is a clear indicator that they don't think I'm that smart, right? I'm not sure how to take it. So I think that for me, the soil health journey has been all of those things. And I think that just it really opened my mind and really let me become a lifelong learner again. And for me, it's just been a lot of fun. So even if you don't do the whole farm or you do part of it, it really can be fun. You learn all kinds of new things and different things and you observe the soil and the ecology and all that. And just it's like I said, just it made farming fun again. And it made it a lot easier for me to sell to my kids because when they saw me miserable when they were young, I think that's why my son didn't want to farm is he's just like, Dad really wasn't having much fun in life. You know, whereas now I'm just like, hey, let's figure out how to make it more fun. And then maybe it'll be more attractive to them or to other young people that might want to work with me.
All right, well, that's where we're going to leave it for today's episode. Thank you so much to Trey Hill for taking time to be on the show. That last point about building onto the legacy of his father and engaging the next generation through these soil health practices, that's definitely going to stick with me. I'm sure you got some great takeaways out of today's episode as well. You can learn more about Trey's farm at their website, which is harborviewfarms.net. And also be sure to check out the Farmers for Soil Health website, which is just farmersforsoilhealth.com. Links to both of those are in the show notes for today's episode. Well, I want to thank the Soy Checkoff for sponsoring this Farmers for Soil Health series of the Soil Sense podcast. This show is produced by Dr. Abby Wick, Dr. Olivia Cayuette, and myself, with support from the United Soybean Board, the University of Missouri Center for Regenerative Agriculture, and the Soil Health Institute. If you're at all interested in what soil health looks like in practice and on the farm, I highly suggest you subscribe and follow this show on your favorite podcast app and leave us a rating and review while you're there. Until next time, stay curious, keep collaborating, and don't forget to take a minute to stop and smell the soil. Have a good one.